From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Lester Graham. Today, we talk with our political commentators about running mates for the candidates for governor. What would work? What might not?
There is a lot of bad blood between those two candidates.
Then we talk with the Libertarian gubernatorial candidate about the general election.
I think if the media held themselves to a higher standard, they would say, you know what, the Libertarian Party has earned an opportunity at the table.
We hear about a fish that dates back to the dinosaurs.
They have some primitive characteristics. Instead of scales, they have bony plates that are arranged in five rows down the length of the body.
And in our Artisans of Michigan series, we find artisans who used to be competitors, and now they're married.
It's pretty rare that two artists that work in the same type of medium get together.
Those stories, plus the controversy about whether it's correct to say the people of Flint were lead poisoned. All of that in just a bit. Welcome to Stateside. I'm Lester Graham. The Department of Health and Human Services announced today it is reinstating federal work requirements for people on food assistance. Starting October 1st, able-bodied adults without dependents will have to work at least 20 hours a week to keep getting food stamps. Those requirements had been suspended since 2002 because of high unemployment rates in the state. Now, of course, the unemployment level is much lower. The state began reinstating work requirements in 14 counties last year. Now all the counties in Michigan will be included. Here to talk more about this is Markel Miller. She's the Director of Community Food Programs with Food Gatherers. So what more can you tell us about this reinstated work requirement?
Sure. Thanks for having me on today. I think what's important to realize about this work requirement is that it doesn't affect that many people. I think many people are going to maintain their benefits and not see anything that impacts their assistance. However, for the people that are subject to the work requirement, it can be pretty disruptive to getting food on the table. We want to make sure people are able to get fed and access those benefits they may be eligible for. One thing we learned about from rolling it out here in Washtenaw County is that many people may be exempt from the work requirement but have to work with their caseworker to update their information on file so that they can maintain benefits.
Well, your group and Food Gatherers and the University of Michigan Taubman College of Architecture and Urban Planning looked into the local impact of work requirements for those receiving benefits from the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, or SNAP. What did you guys find?
Yeah, so we found through a research project we did last year, as you mentioned, in partnership with the University of Michigan, that many people that were subject to the work requirement didn't know that they could volunteer to maintain eligibility if they were having trouble finding employment.
You mean doing volunteer work?
Volunteer work, yep. So volunteering at a nonprofit and then counting those hours and updating your case with the Department of Health and Human Services, those volunteer hours count towards meeting the work requirement so people could maintain eligibility. And so we found that many people weren't aware about that. And one of the lessons learned was getting the word out about the work requirement really helped connect people to opportunities to maintain eligibility. And that was really important for minimizing the impact.
I wanted to ask you, what kind of restrictions are there for receiving food assistance through SNAP?
So it's an income-eligible program, so people have to meet federal income guidelines, and those are not adjusted for different costs of living. And so for a place like Washtenaw County, where there's higher wages and higher costs of living, many people are not eligible for SNAP benefits. They're going to have to meet those federal income thresholds.
So are there limits to how long you can be on it or things like that?
No, as long as you maintain those income eligibility guidelines, you can maintain eligibility for the program.
So what are your main concerns as this new work requirement is reinstated?
That it's going to cause a lot of confusion for people that are potentially eligible to maintain benefits, and they may not have access to a computer or they may face other barriers, and it's hard to update their case. For instance, someone who's struggling with homelessness, they may be exempt from the work requirement because of their current situation, but they're going to have to communicate that and get paperwork to their caseworker so that they can maintain benefits. Someone who may be temporarily injured and unable to work, they're going to be exempt from the work requirement, but again, they're going to have to work with their caseworker to get their case updated to maintain benefits. So it's disruptive for people that are already facing barriers to employment, and we want to make sure that they can maintain benefits that they're eligible for.
When you say working with their caseworker, do they have to go somewhere, or is this something that could be done over the phone? How will they have to deal with that?
That's a great question. So a lot of times people do meet with their caseworker in person. The Department of Health and Human Services has updated their website. It's called My Bridges, and it does now allow for papers to be submitted through the online portal, even by taking a photo through your phone. So there are easier ways, but not everyone has access to computers or has that computer literacy to do it themselves. So we really try to encourage people to working with community nonprofits that are navigation partners, and they can help those individuals who may not have those skills to update their cases.
I imagine that in some rural counties, or even Washtenaw County, you keep mentioning, that could be the travel to see a caseworker could be a real burden if you don't have access to transportation.
Absolutely.
Many people believe if you can work, you should work as a condition of getting food or any other kind of assistance. In fact, they're talking about possibility of this spreading to Medicaid in Michigan. What do you say to that?
Well, the reality is that many people who can work do work. SNAP there is there as a way to help people stay on their feet, stay housed, and be able to bounce back from temporary unemployment. The majority of SNAP benefits and SNAP households have a child, have someone with a disability, have a senior in them. So there's really a small percentage of SNAP going to households that have, single adults in them. And of those households, they're working. Many of them, the vast majority of them are working within the year of receiving SNAP benefits. So the whole purpose and the goal of the SNAP program is to really make sure that people can bounce back if they lose a job or they're in kind of temporary underemployment and not earning enough to make ends meet.
So how many people are actually going to be affected by these new reinstated work requirements?
So they're estimating about 67,000 are going to be affected by these work requirements. And so it's important for those people to get connected to employment opportunities so that they can maintain their benefits.
Markell Miller is the Director of Community Food Programs with Food Gatherers. Thanks very much for telling us about this.
Thank you.
Occasionally, we profile craftspeople around Michigan who handmake the things we use. Well, today it's a two-for-one as we visit Gemini Handmade in downtown Grand Rapids as part of our Artisans of Michigan series. This boutique studio workshop is home to two businesses. Jacob Varun's company is Harbinger Leather Designs. Elise Welcher owns Little Wings Designs. Welcher makes handbags and many kinds of playful accessories, while Varun makes wallets, backpacks, and more rugged sort of outdoorsy products. The two artisans are married.
Funny enough, we met as competitors in town. We both had our own lines, and we were competitors at craft shows, and there was a little bit of that, like, it was very professional, you know? He's another leather worker. Like, kept it very on that level.
Elise Welcher says it's not all that common for husband and wife to both be artists.
Sometimes you are, but you work in different mediums. It's pretty rare that two artists that work in the same type of medium get together.
But Jacob Varun says it works for them.
That's one way in which Elise and I complement each other with the ways our brain works and the ways our businesses work. Sometimes Elise will take the forefront on the organizational side of things, the communication, paying the insurance, the taxes, et cetera, and I will take on the batch manufacturing of my goods and her own. So when our strengths cover each other's weaknesses, it makes it better for both of us to get along.
Mm-hmm. And, I mean, we both love working with our hands. I think we're both very kinetic hands-on people, and so that process of being able to just, like, get into that flow state of making things, you know, it's where we find our most joy. On the other hand, you know, it's tiring. I think that's the biggest thing, is that the impact on our bodies is real. You know, we're constantly cutting, pulling, moving stuff around, you know, outside of the physical making. We do a lot of craft shows and events, so, you know, every summer weekend we're loading and unloading an entire booth setup with a 10x10 Easy Up tent and all of the equipment and gear that goes in that. So it's very physical, active work.
So what'd you just do there?
We just punched out a wallet from a piece of leather using a custom clicker die.
It's like a cookie cutter.
A cookie cutter.
Yeah.
Both of them got into leatherworking because they could not find the kind of products that they really wanted. So they started making them, or at least trying to make them. Varun says his first project was a leather book bag. He found a pattern and he followed it, but that pattern was designed for lighter weight material.
It looked terrible. And so I cut apart everything that I'd hand-stitched, whittled it down, put it back together, and it was slightly better. So after six iterations of trying to make myself the same bag from the same pieces, I wasn't ready to stop. So every paycheck, I would get another piece of leather or another few tools and take over some more of the dining room in the house I was renting. Then I took over my bedroom.
Welcher just felt there was a big gap in leather goods for women.
I didn't see the type of leather goods that, frankly, I wanted in the world. I saw a lot of things that were either your very high-end Hermes designer-type goods, a lot of Harley biker stuff, and a lot of, you know, Filson, very let's go into the woods and camp out sort of thing. And I wanted something that was a little more playful and a little more feminine, but that also was built to last and made well, that wasn't, you know, a junky bag or so expensive that it was like buying a car.
She's attracted to leather because so much of today's quick fashion world is about getting cheap goods into the store and sold quickly, if possible.
So much of that clothing is never actually even purchased. It comes in, it goes out, it never gets bought, it goes to landfills, it goes to third world countries, and it creates a tremendous amount of waste. And then the buyers that buy those products, they don't last. They wear them twice, they fall apart in the wash machine, and it's game over and you throw it in the dump.
Both Welcher and Varun stress how their products are made to last.
A leather worker that I follow on Instagram said recently that their goal is to make goods that if someone sees it at an estate sale 100 years from now, they're going to say like, oh, that's great. I need to have that. Even after it's been banged up and passed down, like I want things that will last.
Their shop, Gemini Handmade, features their work, Little Wings Designs and Harbinger Leather Designs, as well as the work of other artisans and designers in the region, including an artisan of Michigan we featured last summer, Kate Lewis Ceramics. That's Elise Welcher and Jacob Varun, our latest Artisans of Michigan. Support for arts and culture coverage comes in part from the Michigan Council for Arts and Cultural Affairs. Coming up, we'll hear from a Flint doctor who says the children of Flint were poisoned by lead, not just exposed to the toxin. It's an argument recently stirred up by a New York Times editorial written by Dr. Hernan Gomez.
Dr. Gomez's reworking of a statistical analysis does not reflect the full range of factors that affect individual health or community health.
That interview after the break. Stick around. This is Stateside. I'm Lester Graham. An opinion piece in the New York Times has stirred up a war of words. According to the Detroit News, an emergency room doctor at the Hurley Medical Center in Flint persuaded the majority of his physician colleagues to ban using the words lead poisoned to describe exposure to lead from drinking Flint water. That doctor, Hernan Gomez, co-authored the New York Times piece. He argues that labeling Flint's children as poisoned, quote, unjustly stigmatizes their generation. Dr. Gomez was a guest on Stateside on July 23rd. Here's a clip from that interview of him describing his analysis of lead levels in Flint children.
We found that in analyzing all these years, that the actual increase in Flint children could not be differentiated from what occurs randomly year to year. We're not claiming that the coincidence of the increase in the reference range may be due to the water, but we're trying to place it in context. It was no higher than what has occurred randomly in Flint in the past.
With us now is Dr. Lawrence Reynolds. He's a pediatrician in Flint and a member of Governor Snyder's task force on the Flint water crisis. In your opinion, were the people of Flint merely exposed to lead for 18 months, or were they poisoned by a known toxin for 18 months?
Well, first of all, let me say I've been a staff member of the Hurley Department of Pediatrics for the last 26 years, and I recently retired. Secondly, I've been a resident of the city of Flint for the last 26 years and was one of those customers of the Flint Water Department who consumed lead-tainted water for 18 months, despite the reassurances that everything was fine. Now, as a pediatrician, my concern is when you drink lead-tainted water and ingest it and incorporate in your body, and it affects cellular and organ function, if that's not a definition of poisoning, I don't know what is. So essentially, they have made a distinction without a difference. And I understand that when we start talking about environmental health issues, that many of us don't have the training or the background or the lived experience to make that assessment.
Now, words matter, and overgeneralization, as Dr. Gomez has suggested, is a problem. Not all children were exposed to the same levels of lead. Not all Flint children will suffer the same level of damage. But banning the words lead poisoned and substituting lead exposure makes it all seem very benign. How does that affect the politics of this situation?
Well, the politics of the situation are wrapped up in a couple of things. One is the issue of environmental justice, and that is, why should one community suffer adverse effects from policy decisions while other communities are spared those adverse effects? The other issue is environmental health and the idea of health in all policies. So when an action is taken by an unelected government, a state-appointed emergency manager who ignores the complaints of citizens, the action of the city council to change the water source, you have a disaster, which is what we had.
Well, I guess I want to get back to this language, because if the language makes it seem like this is more benign than it actually is, it's important to the politics, because the Flint water debacle, if it's diminished, the politicians won't feel the same urgency to make the changes to work to reduce not just the lead levels in water, but maybe do less to reduce lead exposure from poisoning in old lead-based paints and homes and things like that. So do you think the words really matter in the long run?
Without a doubt. You know, I have to talk to my neighbors, my friends, and members of my household when they ask about the water, and it minimizes their concerns. The lead problem in Flint was just one component of a water crisis. We had bacterial problems, we had Legionella problems, we had disinfection problems, we had byproducts of disinfection problems. So I think that Dr. Gomez's reworking of a statistical analysis does not reflect the full range of factors that affect individual health or community health. And I would like him to stand there and discuss with our patients that lead was not a problem. Lead is not a poison. Don't worry.
Yeah, I don't think he said it wasn't a poison, but at the same time, he seems to be diminishing its impact because of data he's looked at. I want to give an example, because you brought up this in a Detroit News piece. You noted it's easy to imagine a general pediatrician such as yourself telling parents, well, if you cannot breastfeed, bottle feed using formula, which of course would be mixed with water, Flint water, several times a day. So what kind of impact would that have on a baby getting daily doses of lead several times a day for the first 18 months of its life?
Well, let's back the question up and say, what parent would knowingly give their newborn and their infant formula mixed with lead-tainted water 5 to 8 times a day? No parent in their right mind would do so. And why would they not do so? Because what are the words in their mind? Lead is a poison. So here we have a cohort of children who are not subject to the usual blood screening that's required by Medicaid and standard practice. That screening occurs when the children start crawling, walking, doing hand-to-mouth things, and it pertains to the ingestion of paint chips, licking of lead dust off their fingers, or dirt that's contaminated by lead. So the whole sample, or most of the sample, for blood lead levels was made for older children long after an exposure such as this would occur, because the half-life of lead in the blood is only 28 to 35 days.
So you're saying that if they were tested later, we wouldn't know how much lead they were actually exposed to, so the damage might have been done without the telltale high blood lead levels?
Yes. The ingestion and incorporation of lead into the brain, where it can reside for as long as a year, and in the bone and the teeth, where it can reside for decades, is not assessed. So we really have no idea what the actual body lead burden is. Dr. Gomez's article does not address the problems of chronic low-level lead exposure. It does not address accumulation.
Let's bottom line this. Why do you think the majority of the physicians at Hurley Medical Center, these are people you probably know, why did they go along with this proposal to ban the words lead poisoned?
You know, I wish I knew. What comes most readily to mind is that they perhaps don't have enough training and experience in environmental health to make that assessment, and were swayed by the opinion of one or two physicians who published this article.
Dr. Lawrence Reynolds is a general pediatrician in Flint and a member of Governor Snyder's task force on the Flint water crisis. Thanks for taking a moment with us.
Thank you.
Well, the big news in politics this week was the Republican gubernatorial nominee choosing a running mate. Joining me to discuss that are our Friday political commentators. Vicki Barnett is a former mayor of Farmington Hills and a former Democratic legislator. Ken Sikkema is senior policy fellow with Public Sector Consultants and the former Republican majority leader in the state Senate. He joins us via Skype. So Bill Schuette chose Lisa Postumate Lyons as his running mate. She's the Kent County Clerk. She's also a former legislator. Vicki, what do we know about her record?
Well, we know that she was a strong proponent of the Education Achievement Association that took over the Detroit failing schools and was a total disaster. Lisa is, I served with her. She's a very, very nice person, and I was pleased to serve with a bunch of very, very nice people. She was in charge of the Education Committee, and she is very conservative. She voted along with the rest of her caucus for a massive tax change in 2011, and we know that she's the Kent County Clerk, and she is a very conservative choice for Bill Schuette's running mate.
Ken, what does Lisa Lyons bring to the Schuette campaign for governor?
Well, I think she's a good, solid choice for Bill Schuette, maybe surprising because she wasn't on the political pundit's original list, but she's articulate, smart, she's well-versed in issues, she's young but experienced, energetic, well-liked and well-regarded in West Michigan. I think that might help him because the Grand Rapids Area Chamber endorsed his primary opponent, Brian Calley. I think it's a good, solid choice. I think the challenge for both Republican and Democratic gubernatorial candidates is, because I anticipate that Gretchen Whitmer will make a good, solid choice too, is how do you take what are these good choices and find a way to have them actually help you move the needle come November? It's just hard to do, but maybe today with social media being so prevalent, maybe they can find a way to do that.
Speaking of Gretchen Whitmer, she's the Democratic nominee, of course. She's yet to choose a running mate. Some Democrats would like her to choose one of her primary election opponents, Abdul El-Sayed, and El-Sayed said on this program that he would consider that.
We haven't had that conversation. Look, I want to be as helpful as possible. And, you know, if that means that that I'm asked to join the ticket and, you know, we can talk about how we move forward in a direction that is consistent with our shared values, then that'd be great.
Vicki, what do you think of that idea?
I don't think that's going to happen. It was a very contentious primary, and as much as there is a lot of youthful energy on El-Sayed's side,
there is a lot of bad blood between those two candidates. And I would like to see Gretchen choose a candidate that is younger and from Detroit, that is active in social media and is progressive in terms of exciting a young base as well, and with no bad blood. And I think that that choice would probably be the rising star Garland Gilchrist II.
Yeah, we'll talk about him in a little bit. Ken, what do you think of El Sayed as a running mate for Gretchen Whitmer?
Well, it's got to be somebody that Whitmer is just totally comfortable with, and it's not appropriate or even, I don't think I'd be very credible commenting on who the Democrats ought to nominate for, or who Gretchen ought to pick for lieutenant governor. But I think Vicky makes a lot of really good points. You know, if you could find a young African-American leader out of Detroit who could campaign like crazy down in Detroit and help that turn out, that probably makes more sense.
Well, this Garland Gilchrist guy who ran for Detroit City Clerk fits that bill. He's also working now at the University of Michigan in social media, as a matter of fact. Vicky, what does Gilchrist bring to the Democratic ticket?
If he's chosen, I mean, let's preface that. He brings youth, he brings excitement, he brings computer savvy. And we really could use those skills both here on the ticket and in Lansing. He upgraded the computer systems for citizens in Detroit and was very effective in making sure that people in Detroit could contact the city just through their cell phone applications if there was problems with garbage or lighting and other things. He also is raising his kids in Detroit, and he has two twins, well, a set of twins, and plans on sending them to Detroit Public Schools. So he's really enamored with the city that he has moved into and the community that he's building around Corktown. So I think that Gilchrist would be a great choice. There's several other names. Sheldon Neely out of Flint has been a great progressive Democrat in a city that's been really hurt by Snyder's policies, and he would also be a good choice. So I think there's a lot of choices available to Gretchen Whitmer.
You know, I should not forget that we also have Green Party candidates who will be choosing running mates and Libertarian candidates who will be choosing a running mate, because we get criticized quite a bit around here pretending like there's only a Republican and a Democratic Party. But having said all that, Ken, if you were advising these two, that is Schuette and Whitmer, what do you think is really going to work in this state? Because it's a big state, geographically different. Well, the west side, the southeast side, the UP and the north, they're all very different areas. Does geography, like you were mentioning with Kent County, really play that much into it? And if it does good in Kent County, will it do good anywhere else?
Well, if my advice to Gretchen Whitmer and Bill Schuette were helpful, they would have called me.
Well, I was going to suggest why didn't they pick either one of you? I mean, come on. Or Vicky may still get the call. I don't know.
I think the and I've said this before, on the lieutenant governor issue, historically, it is just hard come November after a gazillion dollars have been spent on ads, not just for governor, but U.S. Senate and Congress and ballot proposals, for the lieutenant governor nominees to move the needle. Now, like I said, historically it's hard, but maybe it can be done today. Maybe if you take Lisa Lyons and say, look, just campaign like crazy in West Michigan where you're known and popular, and you take somebody out of Southeast Michigan for the Democrats and do the same. Campaign where you're popular and well-known to help. So it becomes a turnout issue. And to your point is, I really think this election is going to come out to sort of down to a turnout issue where Republicans have figured out they have got to turn out their base to have any hope at all. And of course, vice versa, the Democrats know if they turn out their base, they're probably have an advantage right now.
I think that while Ken is right that nobody goes to the polls to vote for the lieutenant governor candidate specifically, I think that there are things that a lieutenant governor choice can add to an overall ticket.
And with half the population being in Southeast Michigan, you don't want to give up that base, whether they be independents who are now moving very rapidly in the suburban areas toward a Republican choice, and the Democrats that live here. And I think picking somebody from the Detroit area that really helps move Detroit forward and would be a voice for Detroit with the governor's ear would be a very powerful message to send to voters in Southeast Michigan. And the challenge for Bill Schuette is going to be, how does he translate his support for Trump and very, very conservative policies into a more middle-of-the-road vision for the state of Michigan that will translate into voters selecting Lisa and him as the governor and lieutenant governor choice. And I think they have a very difficult task ahead.
Vicki Barnett is a former Democratic legislator. Ken Sikkema is a former Republican legislator. I don't know why these gubernatorial candidates haven't approached you two for lieutenant governor. Clearly the obvious choices, but...
obviously, of course.
All right. You have a great weekend.
You too.
Thanks, Lester.
Up next, we'll hear from the Libertarian Party's candidate for governor.
I guess what I'm looking for is the opportunity to be the third voice at the table that the Libertarians have earned as a result of being a major party. And in doing so, we're going to give Michigan voters a true choice.
Stay with us. You're listening to Stateside from Michigan Radio. This is Stateside. I'm Lester Graham. Well, it's general election season. The primaries are over. And I don't know if you went to the polls, but if you noticed, when you pulled the ballot, there were three parties on the primary ballot this time, Republican, Democrat, and Libertarian. And joining us now is the Libertarian choice for governor, Bill Gelineau. Welcome back to Stateside.
Glad I could be here again.
So when we last talked, we went over several of your positions, your platform, and we'll link to that that previous interview when we post this online. And you feel free to bring them up now, but I want to talk about horse racy kind of stuff. More generally, tell me what the Libertarian Party stands for versus the Republicans and Democrats. What sets you apart?
Well, I have a really interesting meme that we put together that I think is really intellectually honest that shows how we sometimes compare with Democrats. We agree with them very much on social views. We disagree with them on economic matters. With regard to the Republicans, we often disagree with them on many economic matters, but we disagree with them on some of their social views. So I think the thing that I like to say is we believe in freedom in all things, and in that way, we appeal to the best in each of the parties.
So how well does that resonate with voters?
Well, we're getting there, and I guess we're going to find out in November. You know, what I'm really proud of is the number of people after the election took place in that time period after that. I think we've signed up 150 people, which is really an amazing number of people who are willing to step forward to say, I'd like to be more involved. You know, our volunteer force has doubled, and we're really looking forward to the election, and our convention is coming up on the 25th in Romulus. We think that's another opportunity to speak to the public and to have them contrast our views with theirs, and really working very hard to win this thing.
So I want to talk about practical matters, and I don't mean to demean the Libertarian Party or your candidacy at all, but let's talk about some numbers here. The Democrats' choice for governor, Gretchen Whitmer, she got more than 585,000 votes. The Republican choice, Bill Schuette, got nearly 500,000 votes, and you got 3,503 votes. So what does that say to you?
Well, it says, number one, we should get all the precincts in because it's something over 4,000 votes, but that's a small thing for me.
That was with 100% is what I was told, but maybe that was...
Maybe so that's, it's okay. I'm that's having a little fun with you.
It's
been said, you know, there's the way people tell lies, and then there's real lies, damn lies, and then there's statistics. You know, this is one of those things where the numbers may not matter, and here's why. I think most people looking at the Libertarian race said, you know, we're comfortable with either Bill or John because they stand for very much the same things. Whereas in the Republican and Democratic races, there were some very big differences between the candidates and a lot of vitriol that had been done. And so I know people that voted in those races simply because they didn't like somebody else. And I think what it spoke to in our race is that John and I were both acceptable to most Libertarians. I know Libertarians that voted in the Republican or the Democratic race.
So Let's look at those numbers, though, those raw voting numbers in the primary. I know the primary is not the general, but it's the only measure we have at this point. It would seem that statistically speaking, winning the governor's seat is a real stretch for you. So what's the goal of your campaign?
To win the governor's race. And let me tell you why. I think a better example of where the numbers lie, we have to look back to 2016. Gary Johnson got 172,000 votes. I'm very proud of the fact that I'm going to announce right here today that Gary Johnson has endorsed my campaign. And I expect him to be here. I expect Bill Weld to be here. I expect some other national figures to come and help. The bottom line is that the Michigan Libertarian Party is a major party for the first time ever in Michigan history. We are a major party. I look at other states. They don't have a major status yet. So it's an opportunity for the Libertarian Party to be heard and to speak to its values. We have an unprecedented organization. And I think when we put all those things together, our expectations are pretty high. So 172,000 votes was pretty scary to the Clinton campaign when they lost the state by 9,000 votes. So I think we can have a real impact, and that alone, I think, changes the discussion.
Well, when you say an impact, I mean, in a spoiler role like that, or what kind of impact are you trying to make?
Well, that's certainly a starting point, but you know, what I'm working toward is to be included in the debates. I think what the values and the particular policy positions that we advocate are deserving of being in that discussion. One of the more disappointing things for me, I think back to when the League of Women Voters sponsored the debates and let the campaigns, they certainly negotiated a little bit in terms of time to be convenient to have all the candidates there. But it was really outside forces that decided when the debates were going to take place. Now, the Democrats and Republicans are gerrymandering the debates the same way they gerrymander districts. They're making it very difficult for any outside voice to be included.
In what way?
Well, the thing that I find really offensive is the intellectual side of it. You know, we had a statewide debate. It was broadcast on many of the networks. The four Republicans got together. On almost no real policy issue did they disagree, but all four were allowed to speak. And Jim Hines, you know, nice man, but he had no more chance of being the Republican nominee than you might perceive my chance to be governor. And yet he was given the time because he's one of the four Republicans. Democrats did the same thing where they had no substantial policy differences, and yet they were allowed to all be on stage. And as it turns out, Shree, who spent $9 million, was not even close to being nominated. So I guess what I'm looking for is the opportunity to be the third voice at the table that the Libertarians have earned as a result of being a major party. And in doing so, we're going to give Michigan voters a true choice. And I think if the media and others hold the Republican and Democratic parties feet to the fire and require that they include me in the debates, my chances go up quite a bit.
I'm guessing part of the motivation is to continue to keep the Libertarian Party on the ballot, right? You do well, you're on the ballot again in 2 and 4 years, right? If that's the strategy, how long will it take before the Libertarian Party starts winning, I don't know, legislative races or a statewide office, something like that?
Well, I think that possibility may happen. I think predicting such a thing may be difficult. Certainly, some of the policy changes that we advocate is going to work us toward a situation where there may be something more inclusive. Most importantly, if I'm not elected governor, I intend to be involved in a process of bringing ranked choice voting to Michigan. Ranked choice voting passed in Maine in 2016, and not surprisingly, the Democratic-Republican parties of Maine immediately challenged it in court. Our vision of that is to do a constitutional amendment.
Okay, why don't you explain what ranked choice voting
sure.
is?
Sure. What that is essentially is a matter where once the votes are cast, if no one receives 50%, then the lowest candidate gets dropped and those votes get to be recast, if they choose to, for another candidate. And what it does is it helps build consensus. One of the things that I find most disturbing is that both of the main political, you know, the older political parties have become captive to their leadership groups, which have made them more radical and more left and more right. I believe ranked choice voting is the magic that we could bring to democracy to help ensure that we have more consensus. And really, as a candidate, that's who I hope to be. I've pledged to work with Democrats, Republicans, and independents to foster solutions. And I think that ranked choice voting is somewhat where we need to go next.
And that would help strengthen the Libertarian Party?
I think it would strengthen all of the voices that are not now considered. You know, even within the ranks of the Republican and Democratic Party, there are voices that are often muted because they don't have enough support within the party that they have to conform. Libertarians are very much about the marketplace of ideas, and I think ranked choice voting would help that work. I've talked about the Green Party, with whom I have some agreement, but many disagreements as well. But I think that they're deserving to be in the marketplace of ideas.
Day to day, between now and November, what are you going to be doing on the campaign? I mean, what's your day look like typically?
Well, seven opportunities today. We have a couple outreach events, and we have multiple media events, including newspaper, radio, and television. And so it's a lot of work. I'm very fortunate. We have 50 volunteers. I have no paid staff. And those 50 volunteers are increasing in size, and the teams and what they do are expanding. We've been very fortunate. We're fundraising. Of the ones that are in the race at this point, I'll certainly be third.
I want to ask you about something you just mentioned. The Libertarian Party members and Green Party supporters often call us and let us and they believe that the reason the Libertarian Party and the Green Party don't get the kind of votes that they need is because there's a ban on them by media. Now, you've been on this station a few times, and you've been in other media. Do you feel the media are treating the lesser-known parties, Libertarian and Green Party, fairly or not?
Well, fair is a difficult word to use. What I'm concerned about is just journalistic integrity. You know, I give Michigan Public Radio a lot of credit for the opportunities that they've given us. But particularly when you look at the commercial television stations, commercial radio stations, just their language that they use. For example, I despise the term bipartisan. It suggests there are two parties. We really should be thinking of solutions. And in doing so, I think challenge them to include language that says, oh, by the way, I can tell you on election night, very few television stations even mentioned that there was a Libertarian primary. So it was just intellectually false, is lazy. And I think if the media held themselves to a higher standard, they would say, you know what, the Libertarian Party has earned an opportunity at the table. Maybe they won't maintain it 2 years from now, but this year they should be included. And we're going to do everything we can to make sure that that voice is heard.
Bill Gelinno is the Libertarian nominee for governor. Thanks very much for coming in.
Thanks, we could be here.
Recently, we've been looking at recovering species, and today we're going to talk about one of the most ancient species in the Great Lakes region, the sturgeon. Ed Baker is research station manager at the Marquette Fisheries Research Station of the Department of Natural Resources, and I asked him what this fish, the sturgeon, looks like.
There are some that think they look a little bit shark-like. They've got a tail that's shaped similar to a shark, but that's, in my opinion at least, about the only resemblance to sharks. They're pretty unique among the fish fauna of Michigan. They don't have scales. They grow very large. They're the largest fish in Michigan. They can grow over 6 feet long, weigh in excess of 150 pounds.
Wow.
They don't have scales. They have some primitive characteristics. Instead of scales, they have bony plates that are arranged in five rows down the length of the body. These plates are called scutes.
And I understand these guys are basically from the time of the dinosaurs.
Correct, yes. Sturgeon fossils date back several hundred million years to the time of the dinosaurs. So they've been around and very successful critters for a very long time.
So how plentiful was the sturgeon before European settlement of the region?
It's difficult to put a number on that, but we do know that they were one of the most abundant fish in the Great Lakes. Early European explorers made note of sturgeon throughout the Great Lakes and the important relationship that the tribes in the state of Michigan and around the Great Lakes had with sturgeon. Henry Rowe Schoolcraft, in particular, one of the early European explorers, kept a journal during his travels throughout the Great Lakes and noted sturgeon being very abundant in the Ossabaw River around Mackinac Island and the Straits of Mackinac, and then actually wrote a fairly detailed account of the sturgeon and tribal harvest of sturgeon in the Ontonagon River, which is a Lake Superior tributary. His party arrived at the Ontonagon River about the time the sturgeon were spawning. sturgeon run uprivers to spawn, much like salmon. And he described a weir that the tribe had constructed across the river several miles upstream, and they were harvesting sturgeon at this weir, and he noted that they were, could harvest enough sturgeon from the Onondagan River to feed that particular tribe for the entire year.
Wow. So what happened to the population of the sturgeon?
The primary cause of the decline was overharvest. The development of the commercial fishery in the Great Lakes initially was targeting fish other than lake sturgeon, fish like whitefish or lake trout. But because sturgeon were so abundant, they were also being caught with these other species that were being targeted. And they were considered a nuisance. So the commercial fishermen would kill the sturgeon. There are descriptions of sturgeon being piled up on beaches like cordwood. Sturgeon were apparently being used to fuel some of the boilers in the ships that were traveling the Great Lakes at that time. But then there was a commercial value realized for sturgeon. And at a point in the late 1800s, the commercial fishery began targeting sturgeon for their flesh and for their eggs, which could be turned into caviar.
Oh, so we had Great Lakes caviar.
Yes.
Wow.
So the commercial fishery was responsible for the early decline, and they've remained at very low levels since about the early 1900s.
Now, I understand restoration efforts have been going on for a while, but these fish live for a long time, and they don't reproduce like other fish or as quickly as other fish. Is that right?
That's correct, yes. Sturgeon have a very long lifespan. They can outlive humans. They can, as I mentioned earlier, live to be 150-plus years old. They grow very large. The other unique aspects of their biology, which mean that they don't expand their numbers very quickly, is they don't reach sexual maturity until they're about 20 years old. And once a female lake sturgeon reaches sexual maturity, that particular female will spawn once every 3 years or so. And it's these characteristics of their biology that prevent their population numbers from expanding very rapidly.
Now, we've been managing the Great Lakes for fisheries for quite a while. How come, besides this problem you just talked about, why haven't the sturgeon already repopulated to an extent?
It's, I think, a two-part answer. One is just the demographics of the situation, meaning there are such low numbers of sturgeon since the early 1910s that they haven't been able to expand on their own very quickly. The other issue is changes to the habitat that sturgeon require for reproduction, and primarily that is dam construction on the rivers that they use for spawning. A lot of the rivers that lake sturgeon used for spawning historically have been dammed, and these dams are typically built at a point where it prevents access to spawning habitats further upstream. So the sturgeon aren't able to get to their historic spawning habitats.
I saw that this October, 3,000 juvenile sturgeons are going to be released into the Maumee River at Toledo. Are Great Lakes states all releasing sturgeon raised in hatcheries?
There is a widespread effort to try and restore sturgeon population numbers as well as reintroduce them back into rivers that they historically occurred in. So the states of Wisconsin and Michigan and Ohio are all stocking sturgeon. New York is also stocking sturgeon in some of their waters.
I understand sturgeon will eat zebra and quagga mussels, those invasive species that have caused so much havoc in the Great Lakes. Could there eventually be enough sturgeon to keep those mussels in check?
That's, I don't think, a very easy question to answer. I think it's possible that sturgeon abundance in very local areas could be high enough to control zebra or quagga mussels, again, in a localized area. I don't know that they would ever reach an abundance high enough to control them throughout the Great Lakes, though.
Right. I guess there are trillions of those things along the lake bottoms. So,
right. And, you know, and the zebra and quagga mussels are typically found in fairly deep water, deeper than sturgeon typically inhabit.
So if I want to find out more about sturgeons, where would I go?
We've got a lot of interesting information about lake sturgeon on our DNR website. There are other groups that are involved in sturgeon restoration, the Fish and Wildlife Service. You know, there are federal agencies, there are tribal agencies, nonprofit groups. For example, Sturgeon for Tomorrow has their own website. So there are lots of different places to go to find information about lake sturgeon.
If I wanted to see one, where would I go?
That's not an easy thing to do unless you go to the Shedd Aquarium.
Ah.
The Shedd Aquarium does hold sturgeon. The best opportunity to see lake sturgeon in the wild is during the spawning season. And probably the best place in Michigan to see them during the spawning season is the Upper Black River near Onaway. We've got a ongoing research program there, and as I mentioned, the Sturgeon for Tomorrow nonprofit group has a chapter on the Black Lake, and they organize volunteers in the springtime to protect the fish while they're in the river spawning. Sturgeon are very vulnerable to poaching in the springtime when they're in these rivers spawning. And we know that that's been a problem, as well as, you know, the past commercial harvest poaching has been an issue in some places as well. Mm. So you can get to the Sturgeon for Tomorrow website and find out. You can actually sign up as a volunteer to guard the sturgeon and see lots of fish in the Upper Black River.
That is Ed Baker. He's at the Michigan Department of Natural Resources Marquette Fisheries Research Station. Hey, thanks for telling us about the sturgeon.
Hey, thanks for having me on.
By the way, the Toledo Blade reports that some juvenile sturgeon are at the Toledo Zoo's streamside rearing facility and will be there until they're released into the Maumee River in October. Little baby sturgeon. How could you resist? That's Stateside for today. I'm Lester Graham. Thanks for listening. Have a great weekend.